Blackstone Audiobooks presents The Secret Adversary by Agatha Christie. The book is dedicated to all those who lead monotonous lives in the hope that they may experience at second hand the delights and dangers of adventure. Prologue. It was 2 p.m. on the afternoon of May the 7th, 1915. The Lusitania had been struck by two torpedoes in succession and was sinking rapidly, while the boats were being launched with all possible speed. The women and children were being lined up awaiting their turn. Some still clung desperately to husbands and fathers, others clutched their children closely to their breasts. One girl stood alone, slightly apart from the rest. She was quite young, not more than 18. She did not seem afraid, and her grave, steadfast eyes looked straight ahead. "I beg your pardon." A man's voice beside her made her start and turn. She had noticed the speaker more than once amongst the first-class passengers. There had been a hint of mystery about him which had appealed to her imagination. He spoke to no one. If anyone spoke to him, he was quick to rebuff the overture. Also, he had a nervous way of looking over his shoulder with a swift, suspicious glance. She noticed now that he was greatly agitated. There were beads of perspiration on his brow. He was evidently in a state of overmastering fear. And yet he did not strike her as the kind of man who would be afraid to meet death. "Yes?" Her grave eyes met his inquiringly. He stood looking at her with a kind of desperate irresolution. "It must be," he muttered to himself. "Yes, it is the only way." Then aloud he said abruptly, "You are an American?"
"Yes."
"A patriotic one?" The girl flushed.
"I guess you've no right to ask such a thing. Of course I am."
"Don't be offended. You wouldn't be if you knew how much there was at stake. But I've got to trust someone, and it must be a woman."
"Why?"
"Because of women and children first."
He looked round and lowered his voice.
"I'm carrying papers, vitally important papers. They may make all the difference to the Allies in the war. You understand? These papers have got to be saved. They've more chance with you than with me. Will you take them?"
The girl held out her hand.
"Wait, I must warn you. There may be a risk, if I've been followed. I don't think I have, but one never knows. If so, there will be danger. Have you the nerve to go through with it?"
The girl smiled. "I'll go through with it, all right, and I'm real proud to be chosen. What am I to do with them afterwards?"
"Watch the newspapers. I'll advertise in the personal column of the Times, beginning Shipmate. At the end of 3 days, if there's nothing, well, you'll know I'm down and out. Then take the packet to the American Embassy and deliver it into the ambassador's own hands. Is that clear?"
"Quite clear."
"Then be ready. I'm going to say good-bye."
He took her hand in his.
"Good-bye. Good luck to you,"
he said in a louder tone. Her hand closed on the oilskin packet that had lain in his palm. The Lusitania settled with a more decided list to starboard. In answer to a quick command, the girl went forward to take her place in the boat.
Chapter 1. The Young Adventurers Limited.
"Tommy, old thing!"
"Tuppence, old bean!"
The two young people greeted each other affectionately and momentarily blocked the Dover Street tube exit in doing so. The adjective old was misleading. Their united ages would certainly not have totaled 45.
"Not seen you for simply centuries," continued the young man. "Where are you off to? Come and chew a bun with me. We're getting a bit unpopular here, blocking the gangway, as it were. Let's get out of it."
The girl assenting, they started walking down Dover Street towards Piccadilly.
"Now then," said Tommy, "where shall we go?"
The very faint anxiety which underlay his tone did not escape the astute ears of Miss Prudence Cowley, known to her intimate friends for some mysterious reason as Tuppence. She pounced at once.
"Tommy, you're stony."
"Not a bit of it," declared Tommy unconvincingly. "Rolling in cash."
"You always were a shocking liar," said Tuppence severely, "though you did once persuade Sister Greenbank that the doctor had ordered you beer as a tonic but forgotten to write it on the chart. Do you remember?"
Tommy chuckled. "I think I did. Wasn't the old cat in a rage when she found out? Not that she was a bad sort, really, old Mother Greenbank. Good old hospital.
Demobbed like everything else, I suppose.
Tuppen sighed. Yes, you too?
Tommy nodded.
2 months ago.
Gratuity, hinted Tuppence.
Spent.
Oh, Tommy.
No, old thing, not in riotous dissipation, no such luck. The cost of living, ordinary, plain or garden living nowadays, is, I assure you, if you do not know.
My dear child, interrupted Tuppence, there is nothing I do not know about the cost of living. Here we are at Lyons, and we will each of us pay for our own. That's that.
And Tuppence led the way upstairs. The place was full, and they wandered about looking for a table, catching odds and ends of conversation as they did so.
And do you know, she sat down and cried when I told her she couldn't have the flat after all.
It was simply a bargain, my dear, just like the one Mabel Lewis brought from Paris.
Funny scraps one does over here, murmured Tommy. I passed two johnnies in the street today talking about someone called Jane Finn. Did you ever hear such a name?
But at that moment two elderly ladies rose and collected parcels, and Tuppence deftly ensconced herself in one of the vacant seats. Tommy ordered tea and buns. Tuppence ordered tea and buttered toast.
And mind the tea comes in separate teapots, she added severely.
Tommy sat down opposite her.
His bared head revealed a shock of exquisitely slicked back red hair. His face was pleasantly ugly, nondescript yet unmistakably the face of a gentleman and a sportsman. His brown suit was well cut but perilously near the end of its tether. They were an essentially modern-looking couple as they sat there. Tuppence had no claim to beauty, but there was character and charm in the elfin lines of her little face, with its determined chin and large, wide-apart grey eyes that looked mistily out from under straight black brows. She wore a small, bright green toque over her black bobbed hair, and her extremely short and rather shabby skirt revealed a pair of uncommonly dainty ankles. Her appearance presented a valiant attempt at smartness. The tea came at last, and Tuppence, rousing herself from a fit of meditation, poured it out.
"Now then," said Tommy, taking a large bite of bun, "let's get up to date. Remember, I haven't seen you since that time in hospital in 1916."
"Very well,"
Tuppence helped herself liberally to buttered toast.
"Abridged biography of Miss Prudence Cowley, fifth daughter of Archdeacon Cowley of Little Missendale, Suffolk. Miss Cowley left the delights and drudgeries of her home life early in the war and came up to London, where she entered an officers' hospital. First month, washed up 648 plates every day. Second month, promoted to drying aforesaid plates. Third month, promoted to peeling potatoes. Fourth month, promoted to cutting bread and butter. Fifth month, promoted one floor up to duties of ward maid with mop and pail. Sixth month, promoted to waiting at table. Seventh month, pleasing appearance and nice manners so striking that am promoted to waiting on the sisters. Eighth month, slight check in career. Sister Bond ate Sister Westhaven's eggs. Grand row. Ward maid clearly to blame. Inattention in such important matters cannot be too highly censured. Mop and pail again. How are the mighty fallen? Ninth month. Promoted to sweeping outwards, where I found a friend of my childhood in Lieutenant Thomas Beresford, Bow Tommy, whom I had not seen for 5 long years. The meeting was affecting. Tenth month. Reproved by matron for visiting the pictures in company with one of the patients, namely the aforementioned Lieutenant Thomas Beresford. 11th and 12th months, parlour-maid duties resumed with entire success. At the end of the year, left hospital in a blaze of glory. After that, the talented Miss Cowley drove successively a trade delivery van, a motor lorry, and a general. The last was the pleasantest. He was quite a young general.
"What blighter was that?" inquired Tommy. "Perfectly sickening, the way those brass hats drove from the War Office to the Savoy, and from the Savoy to the War Office."
"I've forgotten his name now," confessed Tuppence. "To resume, that was in a way the apex of my career. I next entered a government office. We had several very enjoyable tea-parties. I had intended to become a land-girl, a post-woman, and a bus-conductress by way of rounding off my career, but the armistice intervened. I clung to the office with the true limpet touch for many long months, but alas, I was combed out at last. Since then I've been looking for a job.
Now then, your turn.
There's not so much promotion in mine, said Tommy regretfully, and a great deal less variety. I went out to France again, as you know. Then they sent me to Mesopotamia, and I got wounded for the second time and went into hospital out there. Then I got stuck in Egypt till the armistice happened. Kicked my heels there some time longer, and, as I told you, finally got demobbed. And for 10 long, weary months I've been job-hunting. There aren't any jobs. And if there were, they wouldn't give them to me. What good am I? What do I know about business? Nothing.
Tuppence nodded gloomily. What about the colonies? She suggested. Tommy shook his head.
I shouldn't like the colonies, and I'm perfectly certain they wouldn't like me.
Rich relations?
Again Tommy shook his head.
Oh, Tommy, not even a great-aunt?
I've got an old uncle who's more or less rolling, but he's no good.
Why not?
Wanted to adopt me once. I refused.
I think I remember hearing about it, said Tuppence slowly. You refused because of your mother.
Tommy flushed.
Yes, it would have been a bit rough on the mater. As you know, I was all she had. Old boy hated her, wanted to get me away from her, just a bit of spite.
Your mother's dead, isn't she? Said Tuppence gently.
Tommy nodded. Tuppence's large grey eyes looked misty.
You're a good sort, Tommy. I always knew it.
Rot, said Tommy hastily. Well, that's my position. I'm just about desperate.
So am I. I've hung out as long as I could. I've touted round. I've answered advertisements. I've tried every mortal blessed thing. I've screwed and saved and pinched. But it's no good. I shall have to go home.
Don't you want to?
Of course I don't want to. What's the good of being sentimental? Father's a dear. I'm awfully fond of him. But you've no idea how I worry him. He has that delightful early Victorian view that short skirts and smoking are immoral. You can imagine what a thorn in the flesh I am to him. He just heaved a sigh of relief when the war took me off. You see, there are 7 of us at home. It's awful. All housework and mother's meetings. I've always been the changeling. I don't want to go back, but, oh, Tommy, what else is there to do?
Tommy shook his head sadly.
There was a silence, and then Tuppence burst out, Money, money, money. I think about money morning, noon, and night. I dare say it's mercenary of me, but there it is.
Same here, agreed Tommy with feeling.
I've thought over every imaginable way of getting it, too, continued Tuppence. There are only 3, to be left it, to marry it, or to make it. First is ruled out. I haven't got any rich elderly relatives. Any relatives I have are in homes for decayed gentlewomen. I always help old ladies over crossings and pick up parcels for old gentlemen in case they should turn out to be eccentric millionaires. But not one of them has ever asked me my name, and quite a lot never said thank you.
There was a pause.
Of course, resumed Tuppence, marriage is my best chance. I made up my mind to marry money when I was quite young. Any thinking girl would. I'm not sentimental, you know.
She paused.
Come now, you can't say I'm sentimental, she added sharply.
Oh, certainly not, agreed Tommy hastily. No one would ever think of sentiment in connection with you.
That's not very polite, replied Tuppence. But I dare say you mean it all right. Well, there it is. I'm ready and willing, but I never meet any rich men. All the boys I know are about as hard up as I am.
What about the general? Inquired Tommy.
I fancy he keeps a bicycle shop in time of peace, explained Tuppence. No, there it is. Now you could marry a rich girl.
I'm like you, I don't know any.
That doesn't matter. You can always get to know one. Now if I see a man in a fur coat come out of the Ritz, I can't rush up to him and say, Look here, you're rich, I'd like to know you.
Do you suppose that I should do that to a similarly garbed female?
Don't be silly. You tread on her foot or pick up a handkerchief or something like that. If she thinks you want to know her, she's flattered, and will manage it for you somehow.
You overrate my manly charms, murmured Tommy.
On the other hand, proceeded Tuppence, my millionaire would probably run for his life. No, marriage is fraught with difficulties. Remains to make money.
We've tried that and failed, Tommy reminded her.
We've tried all the orthodox ways, yes. But suppose we try the unorthodox. Tommy, let's be adventurers.
Certainly, replied Tommy cheerfully. How do we begin?
That's the difficulty. If we could make ourselves known, people might hire us to commit crimes for them.
Delightful, commented Tommy, especially coming from a clergyman's daughter.
The moral guilt, Tuppence pointed out, would be theirs, not mine. You must admit that there's a difference between stealing a diamond necklace for yourself and being hired to steal it.
There wouldn't be the least difference if you were caught.
Perhaps not, but I shouldn't be caught. I'm so clever.
Modesty always was your besetting sin, remarked Tommy.
Don't rag. Look here, Tommy, shall we really? Shall we form a business partnership?
Form a company for the stealing of diamond necklaces?
That was only an illustration. Let's have a... What do you call it in bookkeeping?
Don't know. Never did any.
I have, but I always got mixed up and used to put credit entries on the debit side and vice versa, so they fired me out. Oh, I know. A joint venture. It struck me as such a romantic phrase to come across in the middle of musty old figures. It's got an Elizabethan flavour about it. Makes one think of galleons and doubloons. A joint venture.
Trading under the name of the Young Adventurers Limited. Is that your idea, Tuppence?
It's all very well to laugh, but I feel there might be something in it.
How do you propose to get in touch with your would-be employers?
Advertisement, replied Tuppence promptly. Have you got a bit of paper and a pencil? Men usually seem to have, just like we have hairpins and powder puffs. Tommy handed over a rather shabby green notebook, and Tuppence began writing busily. Shall we begin? Young officer, twice wounded in the war.
Certainly not.
Oh, very well, my dear boy. But I can assure you that that sort of thing might touch the heart of an elderly spinster, and she might adopt you, and then there would be no need for you to be a young adventurer at all.
I don't want to be adopted.
I forgot you had a prejudice against it. I was only ragging you. The papers are full up to the brim with that type of thing. Now listen, how's this? Two young adventurers for hire, willing to do anything, go anywhere, pay must be good. We might as well make that clear from the start. Then we might add, no reasonable offer refused, like flats and furniture.
I should think any offer we get in answer to that would be a pretty unreasonable one.
Tommy, you're a genius. That's ever so much more chic. No unreasonable offer refused, if pay is good. How's that?
I shouldn't mention pay again. It looks rather eager.
It couldn't look as eager as I feel. But perhaps you're right. Now, I'll read it straight through. Two young adventurers for hire, willing to do anything, go anywhere, pay must be good, no unreasonable offer refused. How would that strike you if you read it?
It would strike me as either being a hoax or else written by a lunatic.
It's not half so insane as the thing I read this morning, beginning Petunia and signed Best Boy. She tore out the leaf and handed it to Tommy. There you are. Times, I think. Reply to box so-and-so. I expect it will be about 5 shillings. Here's half a crown for my share. Tommy was holding the paper thoughtfully. His face burned a deeper red.
Shall we really try it? He said at last. Shall we, Tuppence? Just for the fun of the thing.
Tommy, you're a sport. I knew you would be. Let's drink to success. She poured some cold dregs of tea into the two cups. Here's to our joint venture, and may it prosper.
The Young Adventurers Limited, responded Tommy.
They put down the cups and laughed, rather uncertainly. Tuppence rose. I must return to my palatial suite at the hostel.
Well, perhaps it's time I stroll round to the Ritz, agreed Tommy with a grin. Where shall we meet, and when?
12 o'clock tomorrow, Piccadilly Tube Station. Will that suit you?
My time is my own, replied Mr. Beresford magnificently.
So long, then.
Goodbye, old thing.
The two young people went off in opposite directions. Tuppence's hostel was situated in what was charitably called Southern Belgravia. For reasons of economy, she did not take a bus. She was halfway across St. James's Park when a man's voice behind her made her start.
Excuse me, it said, but may I speak to you for a moment?
Chapter 2. Mr. Whittington's Offer. Tuppence turned sharply, but the words hovering on the tip of her tongue remained unspoken,
for the man's appearance and manner did not bear out her first and most natural assumption. She hesitated. As if he read her thoughts, the man said quickly, "I can assure you I mean no disrespect." Tuppence believed him. Although she disliked and distrusted him instinctively, she was inclined to acquit him of the particular motive which she had at first attributed to him. She looked him up and down. He was a big man, clean-shaven, with a heavy jowl. His eyes were small and cunning, and shifted their glance under her direct gaze.
"Well, what is it?" she asked.
The man smiled.
"I happened to overhear part of your conversation with the young gentleman in Lyons."
"Well, what of it?"
"Nothing, except that I think I may be of some use to you."
Another inference forced itself into Tuppence's mind.
"You followed me here?"
"I took that liberty."
"And in what way do you think you could be of use to me?"
The man took a card from his pocket and handed it to her with a bow. Tuppence took it and scrutinized it carefully. It bore the inscription, "Mr. Edward Whittington." Below the name were the words, "Estonia Glassware Company," and the address of a city office. Mr. Whittington spoke again.
"If you will call upon me tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, I will lay the details of my proposition before you."
"At 11 o'clock? Said Tuppence doubtfully.
"At 11 o'clock.
Tuppence made up her mind.
"Very well. I'll be there."
"Thank you. Good evening."
He raised his hat with a flourish and walked away. Tuppence remained for some minutes gazing after him. Then she gave a curious movement of her shoulders, rather as a terrier shakes himself.
"The adventures have begun," she murmured to herself. "What does he want me to do, I wonder? There's something about you, Mr. Whittington, that I don't like at all. But on the other hand, I'm not the least bit afraid of you. And, as I've said before, and shall doubtless say again, little Tuppence can look after herself. Thank you."
And with a short, sharp nod of her head, she walked briskly onward. As a result of further meditations, however, she turned aside from the direct route and entered a post office. There she pondered for some moments, a telegraph form in her hand. The thought of a possible 5 shillings spent unnecessarily spurred her to action, and she decided to risk the waste of 9p. Disdaining the spiky pen and thick black treacle which a beneficent government had provided, Tuppence drew out Tommy's pencil, which she had retained, and wrote rapidly, "Don't put in advertisement, we'll explain tomorrow." She addressed it to Tommy at his club, from which in 1 short month he would have to resign, unless a kindly fortune permitted him to renew his subscription.
"It may catch him," she murmured. "Anyway, it's worth trying."
After handing it over the counter, she set out briskly for home, stopping at a baker's to buy 3 pennyworth of new buns. Later, in her tiny cubicle at the top of the house, she munched buns and reflected on the future. What was the Estonia Glassware Company, and what earthly need could it have for her services? A pleasurable thrill of excitement made Tuppence tingle. At any rate, the country vicarage had retreated into the background again. The morrow held possibilities. It was a long time before Tuppence went to sleep that night, and when at length she did, she dreamed that Mr. Whittington had set her to washing up a pile of Estonia glassware which bore an unaccountable resemblance to hospital plates. It wanted some 11:05 when Tuppence reached the block of buildings in which the offices of the Estonia Glassware Company were situated. To arrive before the time would look over-eager, so Tuppence decided to walk to the end of the street and back again. She did so. On the stroke of 11, she plunged into the recesses of the building. The Estonia Glassware Company was on the top floor. There was a lift, but Tuppence chose to walk up. Slightly out of breath, she came to a halt outside the ground-glass door with the legend painted across it, "Estonia Glassware Company." Tuppence knocked. In response to a voice from within, she turned the handle and walked into a small, rather dirty outer office. A middle-aged clerk got down from a high stool at a desk near the window and came towards her inquiringly.
"I have an appointment with Mr. Whittington," said Tuppence.
"Will you come this way, please?"
He crossed to a partition door with private on it, knocked, then opened the door and stood aside to let her pass in. Mr. Whittington was seated behind a large desk covered with papers. Tuppence felt her previous judgment confirmed. There was something wrong about Mr. Whittington. The combination of his sleek prosperity and his shifty eye was not attractive. He looked up and nodded.
"So you've turned up all right. That's good. Sit down, will you?"
Tuppence sat down on the chair facing him. She looked particularly small and demure this morning. She sat there meekly with downcast eyes whilst Mr. Whittington sorted and rustled amongst his papers. Finally he pushed them away and leaned over the desk.
"Now, my dear young lady, let us come to business."
His large face broadened into a smile.
"You want work? Well, I have work to offer you. What should you say now to £100 down and all expenses paid?"
Mr. Whittington leaned back in his chair and thrust his thumbs into the armholes of his waistcoat. Tuppence eyed him warily.
"And the nature of the work?" she demanded.
"Nominal, purely nominal. A pleasant trip, that is all."
"Where to?"
Mr. Whittington smiled again.
"Paris."
"Oh,"
said Tuppence thoughtfully. To herself she said, "Of course, if Father heard that, he would have a fit. But somehow I don't see Mr. Whittington in the role of the gay deceiver."
"Yes," continued Whittington, "what could be more delightful? To put the clock back a few years, a very few, I'm sure, and re-enter one of those charming pensionnats de jeunes filles with which Paris abounds?"
Tuppence interrupted him.
"A pensionnat?"
"Exactly. Madame Colombier's in the Avenue de Neuilly."
Tuppence knew the name well. Nothing could have been more select. She'd had several American friends there. She was more than ever puzzled.
"You want me to go to Madame Colombier's? For how long?"
"That depends. Possibly 3 months."
"And that is all? There are no other conditions?"
"None whatever. You would, of course, go in the character of my ward, and you would hold no communication with your friends. I should have to request absolute secrecy for the time being. By the way, you are English, are you not?"
"Yes."
"Yet you speak with a slight American accent."
"My great pal in hospital was a little American girl. I dare say I picked it up from her. I can soon get out of it again."
"On the contrary, it might be simpler for you to pass as an American. Details about your past life in England might be more difficult to sustain." "Yes, I think that would be decidedly better. Then—"
"One moment, Mr. Whittington. You seem to be taking my consent for granted."
Whittington looked surprised.
"Surely you are not thinking of refusing? I can assure you that Madame Colombier's is a most high-class and orthodox establishment, and the terms are most liberal."
"Exactly," said Tuppence. "That's just it. The terms are almost too liberal, Mr. Whittington. I cannot see any way in which I can be worth that amount of money to you."
"No," said Whittington softly. "Well, I will tell you, I could doubtless obtain someone else for very much less. What I am willing to pay for is a young lady with sufficient intelligence and presence of mind to sustain her part well, and also one who will have sufficient discretion not to ask too many questions."
Tuppence smiled a little. She felt that Whittington had scored.
"There's another thing. So far there has been no mention of Mr. Beresford. Where does he come in?"
"Mr. Beresford?"
"My partner," said Tuppence with dignity. "You saw us together yesterday."
"Oh, yes, but I'm afraid we shan't require his services."
"Then it's off," Tuppence rose. "It's both or neither. Sorry, but that's how it is. Good morning, Mr. Whittington."
"Wait a minute. Let us see if something can't be managed. Sit down again, Miss—"
He paused interrogatively. Tuppence's conscience gave her a passing twinge as she remembered the Archdeacon. She seized hurriedly on the first name that came into her head.
"Jane Finn,"
she said hastily, and then paused, open-mouthed at the effect of those two simple words. All the geniality had faded out of Whittington's face. It was purple with rage, and the veins stood out on the forehead. And behind it all there lurked a sort of incredulous dismay. He leaned forward and hissed savagely,
"So that's your little game, is it?"
Tuppence, though utterly taken aback, nevertheless kept her head. She had not the faintest comprehension of his meaning, but she was naturally quick-witted and felt it imperative to keep her end up, as she phrased it. Whittington went on.
"Been playing with me, have you, all the time, like a cat and mouse? Knew all the time what I wanted you for, but kept up the comedy? Is that it, eh?"
He was cooling down. The red colour was ebbing out of his face. He eyed her keenly.
"Who's been blabbing? Rita?"
Tuppence shook her head. She was doubtful as to how long she could sustain this illusion, but she realized the importance of not dragging an unknown Rita into it. "No," she replied with perfect truth. "Rita knows nothing about me." His eyes still bored into her like gimlets.
"How much do you know?" he shot out.
"Very little indeed," answered Tuppence, and was pleased to note that Whittington's uneasiness was augmented instead of allayed. To have boasted that she knew a lot might have raised doubts in his mind.
"Anyway," snarled Whittington, "you knew enough to come in here and plump out that name."
"It might be my own name," Tuppence pointed out.
"It's likely, isn't it, that there would be two girls with a name like that?"
"Or I might just have hit upon it by chance," continued Tuppence, intoxicated with the success of truthfulness. Mr. Whittington brought his fist down upon the desk with a bang.
"Quit fooling! How much do you know? And how much do you want?"
The last five words took Tuppence's fancy mightily, especially after a meagre breakfast and a supper of buns the night before. Her present part was of the adventuress rather than the adventurous order, but she did not deny its possibilities. She sat up and smiled with the air of one who has the situation thoroughly well in hand. "My dear Mr. Whittington," she said, "let us by all means lay our cards upon the table, and pray do not be so angry. You heard me say yesterday that I proposed to live by my wits. Seems to me that I have now proved I have some wits to live by. I admit I have knowledge of a certain name, but perhaps my knowledge ends there."
"Yes, and perhaps it doesn't," snarled Whittington.
"You insist on misjudging me," said Tuppence, and sighed gently.
"As I said once before," said Whittington angrily, "quit fooling and come to the point. You can't play the innocent with me. You know a great deal more than you're willing to admit."
Tuppence paused a moment to admire her own ingenuity, and then said softly, "I shouldn't like to contradict you, Mr. Whittington."
"So we come to the usual question. How much?"
Tuppence was in a dilemma. So far she had fooled Whittington with complete success, but to mention a palpably impossible sum might awaken his suspicions. An idea flashed across her brain. "Suppose we say a little something down and a fuller discussion of the matter later." Whittington gave her an ugly glance.
"Blackmail, eh?"
Tuppence smiled sweetly. "Oh, no. Shall we say payment of services in advance?" Whittington grunted. "You see," explained Tuppence still sweetly, "I'm so very fond of money."
"You're about the limit, that's what you are,"
growled Whittington with a sort of unwilling admiration.
"You took me in, all right. Thought you were quite a meek little kid with just enough brains for my purpose."
"Life," moralized Tuppence, "is full of surprises."
"All the same," continued Whittington, "someone's been talking. You say it isn't Rita, was it? Oh, come in."
The clerk followed his discreet knock into the room and laid a paper at his master's elbow. "Telephone message just come for you, sir." Whittington snatched it up and read it. A frown gathered on his brow.
"That'll do, Brown. You can go."
The clerk withdrew, closing the door behind him. Whittington turned to Tuppence.
"Come tomorrow at the same time. I'm busy now. There's 50 to go on with."
He rapidly sorted out some notes and pushed them across the table to Tuppence, then stood up, obviously impatient for her to go. The girl counted the notes in a businesslike manner, secured them in her handbag, and rose. "Good morning, Mr. Whittington," she said politely. "At least, au revoir, I should say."
"Exactly, au revoir."
Whittington looked almost genial again, a reversion that aroused in Tuppence a faint misgiving.
"Au revoir, my clever and charming young lady."
Tuppence sped lightly down the stairs. A wild elation possessed her. A neighbouring clock showed the time to be 12:05. "Let's give Tommy a surprise," murmured Tuppence, and hailed a taxi. The cab drew up outside the tube station. Tommy was just within the entrance. His eyes opened to their fullest extent as he hurried forward to assist Tuppence to alight. She smiled at him affectionately and remarked, in a slightly affected voice,
"Pay the thing, will you, old bean? I've got nothing smaller than a 5-pound note."
Chapter 3. A Setback. The moment was not quite so triumphant as it ought to have been. To begin with, the resources of Tommy's pockets were somewhat limited. In the end, the fare was managed, the lady recollecting a plebeian tuppence, and the driver, still holding the varied assortment of coins in his hand, was prevailed upon to move on, which he did after one last hoarse demand as to what the gentleman thought he was giving him.
"I think you've given him too much, Tommy," said Tuppence innocently. "I fancy he wants to give some of it back."
It was possibly this remark which induced the driver to move away.
"Well," said Mr. Beresford, at length able to relieve his feelings, "what the dickens did you want to take a taxi for?"
"I was afraid I might be late and keep you waiting," said Tuppence gently.
"Afraid you might be late? Oh, Lord, I give it up," said Mr. Beresford.
"And really and truly," continued Tuppence, opening her eyes very wide, "I haven't got anything smaller than a 5-pound note."
"You did that part of it very well, old bean, but all the same the fellow wasn't taken in, not for a moment."
"No," said Tuppence thoughtfully, "he didn't believe it. That's the curious part about speaking the truth. No one does believe it. I found that out this morning. Now let's go to lunch. How about the Savoy?"
Tommy grinned.
"How about the Ritz?"
"On second thoughts, I prefer the Piccadilly. It's nearer. We shan't have to take another taxi. Come along."
"Is this a new brand of humour, or is your brain really unhinged?" inquired Tommy.
"Your last supposition is the correct one. I have come into money, and the shock has been too much for me. For that particular form of mental trouble, an eminent physician recommends unlimited hors d'oeuvre, lobster à l'Americaine, chicken Newburgh, and pêche Melba. Let's go and get them."
"Tuppence, old girl, what has really come over you?"
"Oh, unbelieving one!" Tuppence wrenched open her bag. "Look here, and here, and here!"
"Great Jehoshaphat! My dear girl, don't wave fishers aloft like that."
"They're not fishers. They're 5 times better than fishers. And this one's 10 times better."
Tommy groaned.
"I must have been drinking unawares. Am I dreaming, Tuppence? Or do I really behold a large quantity of 5-pound notes being waved about in a dangerous fashion?"
"Even so, O King, now will you come and have lunch?"
"I'll come anywhere. But what have you been doing, holding up a bank?"
"All in good time. Oh, what an awful place Piccadilly Circus is. There's a huge bus bearing down on us. It would be too terrible if they killed the 5-pound notes."
"Grill room?" inquired Tommy as they reached the opposite pavement in safety.
"The other's more expensive," demurred Tuppence.
"That's mere wicked wanton extravagance. Come on below."
"Are you sure I can get all the things I want there?"
"That extremely unwholesome menu you were outlining just now? Of course you can, or as much as is good for you, anyway."
"And now, tell me," said Tommy, unable to restrain his pent-up curiosity any longer, as they sat in state, surrounded by the many hors d'oeuvre of Tuppence's dreams. Miss Cowley told him. "And the curious part of it is," she ended, "that I really did invent the name of Jane Finn. I didn't want to give my own because of poor father, in case I should get mixed up in anything shady."
"Perhaps that's so," said Tommy slowly. "But you didn't invent it."
"What?"
"No, I told it to you, don't you remember? I said yesterday I'd overheard two people talking about a female called Jane Finn. That's what brought the name into your mind so pat."
"So you did. I remember now. How extraordinary!"
Tuppence tailed off into silence. Suddenly she aroused herself.
"Tommy?"
"Yes?"
"What were they like, the two men you passed?"
Tommy frowned in an effort at remembrance.
"Oh, one was a big, fat sort of chap. Clean-shaven, I think, and dark."
"That's him!"
cried Tuppence in an ungrammatical squeal. "That's Whittington! What was the other man like?"
"I can't remember. I didn't notice him particularly. It was really the outlandish name that caught my attention."
"And people say that coincidences don't happen." Tuppence tackled her pesh Melba happily. But Tommy had become serious.
"Look here, Tuppence, old girl, what is this going to lead to?"
"More money," replied his companion.
"I know that. You've only got one idea in your head. What I mean is, what about the next step? How are you going to keep the game up?"
"Oh!" Tuppence laid down her spoon. "You're right, Tommy, it is a bit of a poser.
After all, you know, you can't bluff him forever. You're sure to slip up sooner or later. And anyway, I'm not at all sure that it isn't actionable. Blackmail, you know."
"Nonsense. Blackmail is saying you'll tell unless you're given money. Now there's nothing I could tell, because I don't really know anything."
"Hmm," said Tommy doubtfully. "Well, anyway, what are we going to do? Whittington was in a hurry to get rid of you this morning, but next time he'll want to know something more before he parts with his money. He'll want to know how much you know, and where you got your information from, and a lot of other things that you can't cope with. What are you going to do about it?"
Tuppence frowned severely. "We must think. Order some Turkish coffee, Tommy, stimulating to the brain. Oh, dear, what a lot I have eaten."
"You have made rather a hog of yourself. So have I, for that matter. But I flatter myself that my choice of dishes was more judicious than yours. Two coffees." This was to the waiter. "One Turkish, one French."
Tuppence sipped her coffee with a deeply reflective air, and snubbed Tommy when he spoke to her. "Be quiet, I'm thinking."
"Shades of Pelmanism," said Tommy, and relapsed into silence.
"There," said Tuppence at last, "I've got a plan. Obviously what we've got to do is to find out more about it all."
Tommy applauded.
"Don't jeer. We can only find out through Whittington. We must discover where he lives, what he does, sleuth him, in fact. Now, I can't do it because he knows me, but he only saw you for a minute or two in Lyons. He's not likely to recognize you. After all, one young man is much like another."
"I repudiate that remark utterly. I'm sure my pleasing features and distinguished appearance would single me out from any crowd."
"My plan is this," Tuppence went on calmly. "I'll go alone tomorrow. I'll put him off again like I did today. Doesn't matter if I don't get any more money at once. £50 ought to last us a few days."
"Or even longer."
"You'll hang about outside. When I come out, I shan't speak to you in case he's watching. But I'll take up my stand somewhere near, and when he comes out of the building, I'll drop a handkerchief or something, and off you go."
"Off I go where?"
"Follow him, of course, silly. What do you think of the idea?"
"Sort of thing one reads about in books. I somehow feel that in real life one will feel a bit of an ass standing in the street for hours with nothing to do. People will wonder what I'm up to."
"Not in the city. Everyone's in such a hurry. Probably no one will even notice you at all."
"That's the second time you've made that sort of remark. Never mind, I forgive you. Anyway, it will be rather a lark. What are you doing this afternoon?"
"Well," said Tuppence meditatively, "I had thought of hats. Or perhaps silk stockings, or perhaps—"
"Hold hard," admonished Tommy. "There's a limit to £50. But let's do dinner and a show tonight, at all events."
"Rather." The day passed pleasantly, the evening even more so. Two of the £5 notes were now irretrievably dead. They met by arrangement the following morning and proceeded citywards. Tommy remained on the opposite side of the road while Tuppence plunged into the building. Tommy strolled slowly down to the end of the street, then back again. Just as he came abreast of the buildings, Tuppence darted across the road.
"Tommy!" "Yes, what's up?"
"The place is shut. I can't make anyone hear."
"That's odd."
"Isn't it? Come with me and let's try again."
Tommy followed her. As they passed the third-floor landing, a young clerk came out of an office. He hesitated a moment, then addressed himself to Tuppence. "Were you wanting the Estonia glassware?"
"Yes, please."
"It's closed down, since yesterday afternoon. Company being wound up, they say. Not that I've ever heard of it myself. But anyway, the office is to let."
"Thank you," faltered Tuppence. "I suppose you don't know Mr. Whittington's address?"
"Afraid I don't. They left rather suddenly." "Thank you very much," said Tommy. "Come on, Tuppence."
They descended to the street again, where they gazed at one another blankly.
"That's Tornet,"
said Tommy at length.
"And I never suspected it," wailed Tuppence.
"Cheer up, old thing, it can't be helped."
"Can't it, though?"
Tuppence's little chin shot out defiantly. "Do you think this is the end? If so, you're wrong. It's just the beginning."
"The beginning of what?"
"Of our adventure. Tommy, don't you see, if they're scared enough to run away like this, it shows that there must be a lot in this Jane Finn business. Well, we'll get to the bottom of it. We'll run them down. We'll be sleuths in earnest."
"Yes, but there's no one left to sleuth."
"No, that's why we'll have to start all over again. Lend me that bit of pencil. Thanks. Wait a minute, don't interrupt. There."
Tuppence handed back the pencil and surveyed the piece of paper on which she had written with a satisfied eye.
"What's that?"
"Advertisement."
"You're not going to put that thing in after all."
"No, it's a different one."
She handed him the slip of paper. Tommy read the words on it aloud.
"Wanted. Any information respecting Jane Finn. Apply Y.A.
Chapter 4. Who is Jane Finn? The next day passed slowly. It was necessary to curtail expenditure. Carefully husbanded, £40 would last a long time. Luckily, the weather was fine, and walking is cheap, dictated Tuppence. An outlying picture-house provided them with recreation for the evening. The day of disillusionment had been a Wednesday. On Thursday the advertisement had duly appeared. On Friday letters might be expected to arrive at Tommy's rooms. He had been bound by an honourable promise not to open any such letters if they did arrive, but to repair to the National Gallery, where his colleague would meet him at 10 o'clock. Tuppence was first at the rendezvous. She ensconced herself on a red velvet seat and gazed at the Turners with unseeing eyes until she saw the familiar figure enter the room.
"Well?"
"Well," returned Mr. Beresford provokingly, "which is your favourite picture?"
"Don't be a wretch. Aren't there any answers?"
Tommy shook his head with a deep and somewhat overacted melancholy.
"I didn't want to disappoint you, old thing, by telling you right off. Too bad. Good money wasted," he sighed. "Still, there it is. The advertisement has appeared, and there are only two answers."
"Tommy, you devil," almost screamed Tuppence. "Give them to me. How could you be so mean?"
"Oh, your language, Tuppence, your language. They're very particular at the National Gallery. Government show, you know. And do remember, as I've pointed out to you before, that as a clergyman's daughter, I ought to be on the stage," finished Tuppence with a snap. "That is not what I intended to say. But if you're sure that you have enjoyed to the full the reaction of joy after despair with which I have kindly provided you free of charge, let us get down to our mail, as the saying goes."
Tuppence snatched the two precious envelopes from him unceremoniously and scrutinized them carefully.
"Thick paper, this one. It looks rich. We'll keep it to the last and open the other first."
"Right you are. 1, 2, 3, go."
Tuppence's little thumb ripped open the envelope, and she extracted the contents.
"Dear Sir, referring to your advertisement in this morning's paper, I may be able to be of some use to you. Perhaps you could call and see me at the above address at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Yours truly, A. Carter."
27 Carshalton Gardens," said Tuppence, referring to the address. "That's Gloucester Roadway. Plenty of time to get there if we tube."
"The following," said Tommy, "is the plan of campaign. It is my turn to assume the offensive. Ushered into the presence of Mr. Carter, he and I wish each other good morning, as is customary. He then says, 'Please take a seat, Mr. To which I reply promptly and significantly, 'Edward Whittington.' Whereupon Mr. Carter turns purple in the face and gasps out, 'How much?' Pocketing the usual fee of £50, I rejoin you in the road outside, and we proceed to the next address and repeat the performance."
"Don't be absurd, Tommy. Now for the other letter. Oh, this is from the Ritz."
£100 instead of 50.
"I'll read it. Dear Sir, re your advertisement. I should be glad if you would call round somewhere about lunchtime. Yours truly, Julius P. Hirschheimer."
"Aha," said Tommy. "Do I smell a Bosch, or only an American millionaire of unfortunate ancestry? At all events, we'll call at lunchtime. It's a good time. Frequently leads to free food for two."
Tuppence nodded assent. Now for Carter. We'll have to hurry.
Parshalton Terrace proved to be an unimpeachable row of what Tuppence called ladylike-looking houses. They rang the bell at number 27, and a neat maid answered the door. She looked so respectable that Tuppence's heart sank. Upon Tommy's request for Mr. Carter, she showed them into a small study on the ground floor, where she left them. Hardly a minute elapsed, however, before the door opened, and a tall man with a lean, hawk-like face and a tired manner entered the room. "Mr. Y.A.," he said, and smiled. His smile was distinctly attractive. "Do sit down, both of you." They obeyed. He himself took a chair opposite to Tuppence and smiled at her encouragingly. There was something in the quality of his smile that made the girl's usual readiness desert her. As he did not seem inclined to open the conversation, Tuppence was forced to begin.
"We wanted to know, that is, would you be so kind as to tell us anything you know about Jane Finn?"
"Jane Finn? Ah."
Mr. Carter appeared to reflect.
"Well, the question is, what do you know about her?"
Tuppence drew herself up.
"I don't see that that's got anything to do with it."
"No, but it has, you know. It really has."
He smiled again in his tired way, and continued reflectively.
"So that brings us down to it again. What do you know about Jane Finn?" "Come now," he continued, as Tuppence remained silent. "You must know something to have advertised as you did."
He leaned forward a little. His weary voice held a hint of persuasiveness.
"Suppose you tell me."
There was something very magnetic about Mr. Carter's personality. Tuppence seemed to shake herself free of it with an effort as she said,
"We couldn't do that, could we, Tommy?"
But to her surprise, her companion did not back her up. His eyes were fixed on Mr. Carter, and his tone, when he spoke, held an unusual note of deference.
"I dare say the little we know won't be any good to you, sir, but such as it is, you're welcome to it."
"Tommy!"
cried out Tuppence in surprise. Mr. Carter slewed round in his chair. His eyes asked a question. Tommy nodded.
"Yes, sir. I recognised you at once. Saw you in France when I was with the intelligence. As soon as you came into the room, I knew—"
Mr. Carter held up his hand. "No names, please. I'm known as Mr. Carter here. It's my cousin's house, by the way. She's willing to lend it to me sometimes when it's a case of working on strictly unofficial lines."
"Well, now,"
he looked from one to the other,
"who's going to tell me the story?" "Fire ahead, Tuppence," directed Tommy. "It's your yarn." "Yes, little lady, out with it."
And obediently Tuppence did out with it, telling the whole story from the forming of the Young Adventurers Limited downwards. Mr. Carter listened in silence with a resumption of his tired manner. Now and then he passed his hand across his lips as though to hide a smile. When she had finished, he nodded gravely.
"Not much, but suggestive. Quite suggestive. If you'll excuse my saying so, you're a curious young couple. I don't know. You might succeed where others have failed. Ha! I believe in luck, you know. Always have."
He paused a moment and then went on.
"Well, how about it? You're out for adventure. How would you like to work for me? All quite unofficial, you know. Expenses paid and a moderate screw."
Tuppence gazed at him, her lips parted, her eyes growing wider and wider.
"What should we have to do?" she breathed.
Mr. Carter smiled.
"Just go on with what you're doing now. Find Jane Finn."
"Yes, but who is Jane Finn?"
Mr. Carter nodded gravely.
"Yes, you're entitled to know that, I think."
He leaned back in his chair, crossed his legs, brought the tips of his fingers together, and began in a low monotone.
"Secret diplomacy, which, by the way, is nearly always bad policy, does not concern you. It will be sufficient to say that in the early days of 1915 a certain document came into being. It was the draft of a secret agreement, treaty, call it what you like. It was drawn up, ready for signature by the various representatives, and drawn up in America, at that time a neutral country. It was dispatched to England by a special messenger selected for that purpose, a young affair called Danvers.
It was hoped that the whole affair had been kept so secret that nothing would have leaked out. That kind of hope is usually disappointed. Somebody always talks. Danvers sailed for England on the Lusitania. He carried the precious papers in an oilskin packet which he wore next his skin. It was on that particular voyage that the Lusitania was torpedoed and sunk. Danvers was among the list of those missing. Eventually his body was washed ashore and identified beyond any possible doubt, but the oilskin packet was missing. The question was, had it been taken from him, or had he himself passed it on into another's keeping? There were a few incidents that strengthened the possibility of the latter theory. After the torpedo struck the ship, in the few moments during the launching of the boat, Danvers was seen speaking to a young American girl. No one actually saw him pass anything to her, but he might have done so. It seems to me quite likely that he entrusted the papers to this girl, believing that she, as a woman, had a greater chance of bringing them safely to shore. But if so, where was the girl, and what had she done with the papers? By later advice from America, it seemed likely that Danvers had been closely shadowed on the way over. Was this girl in league with his enemies? Or had she in her turn been shadowed, and either tricked or forced into handing over the precious packet? We set to work to trace her out. It proved unexpectedly difficult. Her name was Jane Finn, and it duly appeared among the list of the survivors, but the girl herself seemed to have vanished completely. Inquiries into her antecedents did little to help us. She was an orphan, and had been what we should call over here a pupil teacher in a small school out west. Her passport had been made out for Paris, where she was going to join the staff of a hospital. She had offered her services voluntarily, and after some correspondence they had been accepted. Having seen her name in the list of the saved from the Lusitania, the staff of the hospital were naturally very surprised at her not arriving to take up her billet, and at not hearing from her in any way. Well, every effort was made to trace the young lady, but all in vain. We tracked her across Ireland, but nothing could be heard of her after she set foot in England. No use was made of the draft treaty, as might very easily have been done, and we therefore came to the conclusion that Danvers had, after all, destroyed it. The war entered on another phase, the diplomatic aspect changed accordingly, and the treaty was never redrafted. Rumours as to its existence were emphatically denied. The disappearance of Jane Finn was forgotten, and the whole affair was lost in oblivion. Mr. Carter paused, and Tuppence broke in impatiently. "But why is it all cropped up again? The war's over." A hint of alertness came into Mr. Carter's manner. Because it seems that the papers were not destroyed after all, and that they might be resurrected today with a new and deadly significance. Tuppence stared. Mr. Carter nodded. Yes, 5 years ago that draft treaty was a weapon in our hands. Today it is a weapon against us. It was a gigantic blunder. If its terms were made public, it would mean disaster. It might possibly bring about another war, not with Germany this time. That is an extreme possibility, and I do not believe in its likelihood myself. But that document undoubtedly implicates a number of our statesmen whom we cannot afford to have discredited in any way at the present moment. As a party cry for Labour, it would be irresistible, and a Labour government at this juncture would, in my opinion, be a grave disability for British trade. And that is a mere nothing to the real danger. He paused and then said quietly, "You may perhaps have heard or read that there is Bolshevist influence at work behind the present Labour unrest?" Tuppence nodded. "That is the truth. Bolshevist gold is pouring into this country for the specific purpose of procuring a revolution. And there is a certain man, a man whose real name is unknown to us, who is working in the dark for his own ends. The Bolshevists are behind the Labour unrest. But this man is behind the Bolshevists. Who is he? We do not know. He's always spoken of by the unassuming title of Mr. Brown. But one thing is certain, he is the master criminal of this age. He controls a marvellous organization. Most of the peace propaganda during the war was originated and financed by him. His spies are everywhere." "A naturalized German?" asked Tommy. "On the contrary, I have every reason to believe he is an Englishman. He was pro-German as he would have been pro-Boer. What he seeks to attain we do not know,
probably supreme power for himself, of a kind unique in history. We have no clue as to his real personality. It is reported that even his own followers are ignorant of it. Where we have come across his tracks, he has always played a secondary part. Somebody else assumes the chief role. But afterwards we always find that there has been some non-entity, a servant or a clerk, who has remained in the background unnoticed, and that the elusive Mr. Brown has escaped us once more.
Oh! Tuppence jumped. I wonder...
Yes?
I remember in Mr. Whittington's office. The clerk, he called him Brown. You don't think...
Cotter nodded thoughtfully. Very likely. A curious point is that the name is usually mentioned. An idiosyncrasy of genius. Can you describe him at all?
I really didn't notice. He was quite ordinary, just like anyone else.
Mr. Carter sighed in his tired manner. That is the invariable description of Mr. Brown. Brought a telephone message to the man Whittington, did he? Notice a telephone in the outer office? Tuppence thought.
No, I don't think I did.
Exactly. That message was Mr. Brown's way of giving an order to his subordinate. He overheard the whole conversation, of course. Was it after that that Whittington handed you over the money and told you to come the following day? Tuppence nodded. Yes, undoubtedly the hand of Mr. Brown. Mr. Carter paused. Well, there it is. You see what you're pitting yourselves against? Possibly the finest criminal brain of the age. I don't quite like it, you know. You're such young things, both of you. I shouldn't like anything to happen to you.
It won't,
Tuppence assured him positively. I look after her, sir, said Tommy.
And I look after you, retorted Tuppence, resenting the manly assertion.
Well, then, look after each other, said Mr. Carter, smiling. Now, let's get back to business. There's something mysterious about this draft treaty that we haven't fathomed yet. We've been threatened with it in plain and unmistakable terms. The revolutionary element as good as declare that it's in their hands and that they intend to produce it at a given moment. On the other hand, they're clearly at fault about many of its provisions. The government consider it as mere bluff on their part, and rightly or wrongly have stuck to the policy of absolute denial. I'm not so sure. There have been hints, indiscreet allusions, that seem to indicate that the menace is a real one. The position is much as though they had got hold of an incriminating document, but couldn't read it because it was in cipher. But we know that the draft treaty wasn't in cipher, couldn't be in the nature of things, so that won't wash. But there's something. Of course, Jane Finn may be dead for all we know, but I don't think so. The curious thing is that they're trying to get information about the girl from us.
What?
Yes. One or two little things have cropped up. And your story, little lady, confirms my idea. They know we're looking for Jane Finn. Well, they'll produce a Jane Finn of their own, say at a pensionnat in Paris. Tuppence gasped, and Mr. Carter smiled. No one knows in the least what she looks like, so that's all right. She's primed with a trumped-up tail, and her real business is to get as much information as possible out of us. See the idea?
Then you think...
Tuppence paused to grasp the supposition fully.
That it was as Jane Finn that they wanted me to go to Paris?
Mr. Carter smiled more wearily than ever. "I believe in coincidences, you know," he said.